And tonight on the program, we're very pleased to have Stuart McLean joining us on the telephone. Stuart is, of course, a best-selling author. He's an award-winning journalist and humorist. He's the host of the CBC program, The Vinyl Cafe, and he has a long list of accomplishments that are kind of too long to mention or we won't have time to talk. Stuart, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I love to have the radio on when I'm home, and radio is so great because you can walk around and do whatever you're doing, and you can either tune in and tune out. But the first time I heard you on the radio, I was tuning out in the other room, and your voice came on, and it was like, it just made me stand up and listen, walk to the other room. Who is this guy? Your voice, I guess I would describe it, and this is in a good way. It sounded sort of like Jimmy Stewart after too many cups of coffee. You know, you've just picked up the pace from what we usually hear from Jimmy Stewart, but it just kind of makes me sit up in bed is what I think about.
You're not the first person to say that to me. In fact, I came back from Ireland, and I was in a taxi cab in London on my way through London, England, on my way back from Dublin. And after about a minute, the cabbie said to me in this London cab, he said, may I tell you who you remind me of? And he said, Jimmy Stewart. And it's funny because I saw Stewart on stage once years ago. I was just as a lad. I was in London, England, and I went to a stage remounting of Harvey, you know, the rabbit, and he was there on stage. And that's probably the only time I've seen him. I'm a radio guy too, and I don't watch a lot of television. And I might have seen bits and pieces of It's a Wonderful Life, and that's about it. I lead a strangely cloistered cinematic life, and so it's not. I didn't set out to copy Stewart, but.
No, of course not. It's just the way that you sound.
It's just the way it is.
Naturally. Yeah. You started your career in radio, kind of doing radio documentaries and more newsy kind of things and stories, I assume, for CBC Radio. How did it evolve to telling stories of your own on your own program? Can you fill us in a little bit?
Yeah, I worked for CBC, which is Canada's version of public radio. And for 30 years, and I began as a serious journalist, I guess, or doing hard news anyway, documentaries, feature documentaries, more or less writing for a show which was the radio of equivalent of the Sunday New York Times. We had a review of the week, complete with a sort of magazine section, and I would do feature documentaries. And I think as an artist, as a writer, because I am a writer at heart. Radio, even though I spent 30 years in the radio, radio is a very writerly medium, or it can be a writerly medium. You can be a writer on the radio, more so maybe than television, where it's really a photographer, it's a cameraman's medium. If you are a writer, you have to write with the pictures for television. Radio, all you have of the words. And as an artist, I think you're always looking for thin ice. You want to be working somewhere where you're feeling unsafe or where you're feeling challenged, where you don't know what the rules are. And I remember after about 7 or 8 years of making documentaries, one night being alone in an editing room, working on a documentary, editing stuff and writing the piece, and coming to a problem. I boxed myself in some way structurally in this piece, and I thought, now how am I going to get out of this? And I immediately knew that I said, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll do just like I did 6 months ago when I had the same problem. And I remember going, whoa, that's, I got a bigger problem now. I've come to the end of this, because once you start repeating yourself and using tricks that you've already invented, you're really only a hop, skip, and a jump from boredom. And once you get bored, the audience will get bored. So I knew then that I had to move on, and I eventually moved on to doing a different kind of radio piece. I did a commentary piece, or a more casual talk piece, kind of instead of hard journalism, more like the sort of pieces that you would find at the beginning of the New Yorker magazine, talk of the town pieces, sort of things that E.B. White might have written years ago. And then that one day somebody came along to me and said, do you want to try, you and I should do a show together. And they were thinking of a music show. And I had heard years ago, once or twice, I was courting a girl who lived in Maine, and I had heard Garrison Keillor's show, and his storytelling appealed to me. And I said, well, we have to do more of it, more than just introduce records. We have to do it with some, we have to create a world. And that's where the Vinyl Cafe came from. It was creating this fictional world of a fellow who owned a secondhand record store. And the show was going to be, in the early days, it was just all going to be the music that this guy had in his record store, and then it evolved into what it is today.
You know, that's interesting the way you told that, because one of the things that I really like about listening to you is that you take your time with the topic.
Is the interview over now? We run out of time?
No, not at all. I mean, in your stories, you really evolve them into something that's become kind of a lost art. You know, we do a lot of communicating these days, a lot of it, more than ever before, but it's not really the communicating like sitting around a table drinking tea or coffee, where you take your time and you listen and, you know, you work back and forth. And that's the way I feel listening to stories like you tell on Vinyl Cafe.
Well, I think people love to hear stories, and I think good stories take time in the telling. And I've been lucky over the last 30 years to have always worked in sort of a long form of journalism. Even when I was doing hard news, I worked in the feature department. I've always been afforded enough time so that I can relax and tell stories the way we might tell it around the kitchen table.
How much work was involved in developing those techniques? Was that something that, because you were a writer, that came more naturally to you, or are these techniques that you had to develop?
It was interesting. I learned, well, I suppose first off, I learned the technical part of writing from the editors who edited me, and having my work torn apart and put back together on deadline, and them saying not this but this, or don't do that, do this. And that's how I learned technically how to be a writer, and that took about 10 years to happen, I think, and it happened slowly. And then after doing it for 10 years, I found my voice as a writer, which is that I found the way I wanted to write and the things I wanted to write about, my style and my and the material, you know, the fields that I want to plow. And then having done that, having found my voice and having learned the technical part, then I started working my trade, which is, so it took maybe 20 years before I was really really confidently driving the car. And it happens slowly, and it happens without you noticing it happening. So when people ask me about writing and how to learn, you know, what should I do? I always say that they should just get themselves a deadline, that they should somehow place themselves in a position where they have to write, and where they have to write for others, where others will see their work and give them feedback, and then slowly, if you're lucky, over the years you will learn how to do it, and then if you're really lucky, you will find your voice.
All you need is a little pressure, in other words.
Oh, pressure for sure. You know, no. Well, I think it was Johnson who said, "None but a fool writes, but for money." So maybe if you can make it your work, that's really good. But if you can't, if it isn't your work, you should make it your avocation, and you should find ways to make it happen. I mean, the Olympics are on right now, and the Olympics you know, some nights that I would love to be just sitting in front of the television watching, and I won't be because I'm on deadline to write a story, and there's all sorts of reasons not to be sitting in front of the computer writing. There's always more enticing things to do, more fun, easier, less threatening, less frustrating. But what keeps me going is that I've got these deadlines and I have to produce, and you've got to put yourself in that position. And you can do that by, you know, taking a creative writing course or joining a writer's group or volunteering for a small community newspaper or getting yourself a job in the business. But that's how you learn.
Now, one time you were a director of the broadcast division of a school of journalism. Mm. It seems there's a lot of difference between writing in print and writing for somebody who's going to speak.
No, oh well, there is technically. The way you write, the way I write for my radio show is different than how I write for my books. You know, so technically there is, but not conceptually. Because at the conceptual level, it's all about storytelling, and once you know how to do it one way, you can do it other ways. Because really, there are three things that you have to be able to do. You have to be able to recognize a story. You have to be able to, you know, as the world goes by, say that's what we should write about. Mm-hmm. Then you've got to know how to research a story, which is to gather the facts up about it. And then you have to know how to record it or write it down. And if you can do those three things, recognize, research, and write it, then it's a very easy thing to switch over from writing for the radio or writing for a movie or writing for a book. There are rules, and it's different for each medium, but they're. That's the technical part isn't the important part. The technical part is being able to do those other things, recognize and research and then write the stuff.
You've been doing this for some time, and I don't know how many stories would have evolved, plus the ones that didn't work for your program. Are there, and not long ago I heard one that you did about curling, and I just about... I was laughing so hard, you know, because it was perfect. You know, it was right on to what a lot of people don't know about curling or a sport like that. But are there stories out there where you can say, hey, I really hit that one? You know, that,
oh, yeah.
I really loved that one.
Oh, yeah, sure. There are stories that where I where you, where when you finished, you know, you look at it and you... and you just sit back with satisfaction and know that you've done it well. And then there's other times, where you know you haven't done so well. And sometimes that you have to be okay with that. You know, you can only do great work because you sometimes do good work. And that again is one of the great writerly lessons you learn having been a journalist, because. You'll never get writer's block if you've been a journalist because you do get writer's block. You sometimes do find yourself blocked. You think to mm-hmm. yourself, I can't do this one. I don't know how to do this, or I have too much information and I don't see my way through it, or I don't have enough information, or I don't understand this. And you'll go to your editor and say, I can't deliver this tonight for 6:00. And they'll look at you and they'll say, you have to. And you'll say, well, I can't. And they say, well, you know, we're putting out the paper or we're putting on the show and we have a hole that you have to fill because no one else can fill it. And then you drag yourself back to your typewriter muttering and saying unpolite things. And then you sit down and you say, well, and you know, and then you do it. And sometimes under those circumstances, when you do it, you turn out your best work and you think, oh, or sometimes you turn out maybe just your average work, but you realize, well, okay, that was my average work today and tomorrow will be better. And you'll, and that's how you you learn that great work appears under various different pressures and under various different, you know, impulses. But no matter how hard it might feel or impossible it might even feel, that, you know, work will appear if you just sit down and do it.
Sometimes you get stories from your audience, people... send in mm-hmm. stories that are their favorites or experiences they've had.
Yeah.
How often do they work just as they are, and how much work do you have to put into them?
We have a segment on the show called The Story Exchange, and we ask people to write in, and we tell them that their stories have to be true and they have to be short, and after that they can be anything they want. And I don't do that section. My producer does that section. When we began this part of the show, we got about 10,000, and I think we're up to around 15 or somewhere between 15 and 20,000 submissions now. People, we tapped into something very deep, this urge to tell our own stories, for people to tell their stories. So there's an enormous amount of stuff came in, and it goes through a screening process. Somebody on the staff, we have a very small staff. There's really only 2.5 of us working on the show, and our production assistant reads everything, pulls out the 10 or 20 that she thinks are good, passes them over to Jess, who's my producer, Jess Milton, and Jess then edits them down, and they're usually edited, just like my work, pretty substantially. My work gets edited. I'm working on a story right now for the show we're doing in Thunder Bay soon, and I just threw out the first 1,600 words I wrote in a 3,000 word story.
Oh,
so this
man.
Is like that's 50% of it, and I threw it out, and it's good words. I mean, my editor said I showed the story to two people, my producer and my editor. My producer said those first 1,600 words were my favorite part of the story, and my editor said, I think we have to drop these first 1,600 words. They're really good, but they don't build the story. They don't help the plot develop the way you want it to.
Oh, that's
so
gonna
I'm
be
throwing away 1,600 of my favorite and my producer's favorite words because they don't serve the story. So all writers get edited, even people like me who've been doing it for 30 years and have been doing the show for 15. You'd think I could toss these things off, but I don't. You work, and they sound tossed off. That's the thing. They sound as if they were they're easy as pie. And the reason they sound easy as pie is because we work so hard to make them sound like that.
That's what makes them so good.
Well, there's no birth without blood. You have to struggle to make things. You have to struggle to make things sound easy. That is maybe one of the reasons why beginning writers feel so frustrated. They think that sounds so easy, and then they try and they compare their work to my work and think, well, it's not as good as him. The thing is, what they don't understand is my first draft isn't as good as me either. That I have to work, I have to rewrite it, and do so with the help of others. First, the help of my producer, and then the collaboration of my audience. We do these shows in theaters. And I learn from the audience what's working and what isn't working. And every night after a show, my producer and I will huddle and look at the script and change it based on what we've learned that night, from the silences or from the intensity of the listening or from the laughter or from whatever is happening in the room that night.
You mentioned before how many people have sent in their own stories, and that's an amazing amount of our participation from your listeners.
It's incredible.
Our folks out there should realize that more than 700,000 people listen to the Vinyl Cafe every weekend on either Sirius Satellite Radio or CBC Radio, or here on WTIP. We have you on from Tuesdays to 4, from 4 to 5 p.m. and Sundays from 11 till noon, and it's become such a popular show in a relatively short period of time. That's a lot of listeners out there, and I have to congratulate you on an amazing audience.
Well, it is amazing, and actually the numbers are higher because that's an old Canadian number. We're up about 800,000 Canadians on CBC, and then when you add in the other numbers, we're on in about 18 states across the United States now and about 80 markets, and those figures aren't there, and the Sirius figures aren't there either, and so we're probably over 1 million people listening, which is...
That's huge.
That is big when it's in a modest way, because it's just modest little public radio stations that it's on, who don't get the lion's share of the market anyway. So in a modest way, it's a substantial number of people who gather together around a radio to hear stories. And I mean, I'm pleased that it's my show, and I'm pleased that, you know, they're my stories, but I'm also very pleased that in this this time of our lives, that it's happening, and not because it's me, but just because I like it that people and come to theater. So see me standing on a stage without any flashing lights or smoke pots or anything, really, just to stand there with a lectern and tell a story. It makes me, it encourages me and reassures me that we still have people who will come together to do that, who are interested in that.
And, of course, we're speaking with Stuart McLean from the Vinyl Cafe. And, Stuart, you're going to be in Thunder Bay on March 18th. Mm-hmm. I believe it's 7:30 Eastern Time at the Thunder Bay Community Auditorium. And as you mentioned, you're already working on that piece that you'll be delivering that night. I imagine you have had to research where you're going so you know what stories relate to Thunder Bay or Timmins.
Well, I've been to Thunder Bay before. I know. Okay. I feel I have a fond connection with Thunder Bay, and where we'll be telling three stories that night, or two brand new Dave and Morley stories, two new stories about this guy who owns the record store and his family, and one old favorite, and there'll be the Good Lovelies are coming with us, which is a group of kind of harmony singing women from Toronto, three women who sound not unlike the Andrews sisters used to sound, and plus, you know, some other musicians and plus other stuff. So we're putting the show together now. Two of the stories are done, and I'm working on the second edit of the final one right now.
Sounds great. And I want to remind our listeners that is 6:30 our time, and that's the 18th at Thunder Bay Auditorium. And of course, tickets are certainly available, and as so far they're still available, so it's a great time to see Stuart McLean and listen to him and enjoy those great stories. Stuart, you know, I know how busy you are, and I just want to thank you so much from us here at WTIP and giving us your time, and also for making our station quite a bit better by appearing twice weekly on our programming.
That's very sweet. I haven't Jess has been and visited you guys, and she has talked to me about the station and told me about her visit to your log cabin or your log building, and how lovely it was, and told me about she told me about the Moose Cafe
the Java Moose
in Chicago. Is that in the Chicago Bay Market? Is that, like, I don't know if I should talk. Anyway, I remember talking about cinnamon buns and
yes, that's in Hovland,
and other things, and a fish market she visited. So I'd love to get down to your neck of